Welcome to Defiant Health Radio, a place where you can count on hearing about the truth in health, uncolored by interests of big pharma, the generally misplaced motivations of healthcare and doctors, just ideas and strategies that work safely, effectively, and inexpensively. I'm your host, Dr. William Davis, cardiologist and author of the Wheat Belly and Undoctored books, and now my newest book, Super Gut, a book that gives you a blueprint on rebuilding a healthy microbiome to take back control over weight, health, and aging. In this episode of Defiant Health Podcast, let me tell you about five things cardiologists will not tell you about heart health. Having practiced cardiology for 25 years, I learned what works and what does not work to prevent heart disease. Sadly, follow conventional health and diet advice from most cardiologists and other doctors, and you are following a recipe for developing heart disease, as well as type 2 diabetes, weight gain, fatty liver, and numerous other health conditions. Did you catch that? I'll say it again. Conventional diet and health advice causes heart disease and other common health conditions. Think of it. More than 80 million Americans now take statin drugs to reduce cholesterol. That must mean that heart disease, conditions like heart attack and sudden cardiac death, are declining, but they're not. Heart centers that deliver procedures like coronary angioplasty, stent implantation, and implantation of defibrillators are as busy as ever. After all, heart disease is the number one moneymaker for hospitals. It means that heart disease is big business, a business driven by greed and the need to grow the business. It is most certainly not based on delivering health and prevention of heart disease. Given all that, what are you not being told by cardiologists and doctors? Let's discuss that question in this episode of Defiant Health. Later in the podcast, let's talk about Defiant Health's sponsor, Paleo Valley, their fermented grass-fed beef sticks, bone broth protein rich in collagen, organic super greens, and low-carb super food bars have among the cleanest ingredient lists for any products of their kind. They're also expanding their Wild Pastures service that delivers 100% grass-fed and finished pastured meats from a regenerative family farm right to your door. And they have more recently introduced some interesting new products, including chocolate-flavored grass-fed bone broth protein, grass-fed organ complex in capsule form, and essential electrolytes to add to your intake of electrolytes such as magnesium. I'd also like to introduce you to a product I formulated, an oral product for skin health that I call Gut to Glow, a combination of a probiotic microbe combined with marine-sourced collagen hydrolysates, astaxanthin, the carotenoid, and hyaluronic acid that I believe is yielding some very interesting skin health benefits. So let's talk about these five things that the majority of cardiologists, my colleagues, will not tell you. Now, I didn't come to these conclusions overnight. Over 17 years of education, training, and 25 years of practice in cardiology, I learned a lot of lessons, but I also came to realize that what I'd been educated and trained to do was to participate in the business of cardiology, not necessarily the health of cardiology or any other aspect of health. So much time and energy was devoted to how to deliver pharmaceuticals and medical procedures that built the business of cardiology, showing me how to put in more stents, do more balloon angioplasty, acquire new devices that had charges that were higher than for balloon angioplasty, how to set somebody up with a defibrillator. In other words, revenue-generating procedures as well as pharmaceuticals. But where was the conversation about genuine heart health? There's a lot of lip service to things that appear to be heart healthy, but a real message of heart health is simply not delivered. You know, a lot of these insights for me came after my mom died. She'd undergone a successful two-vessel coronary angioplasty, meaning she had two blockages ballooned in her coronary arteries, in her heart's arteries, and then was found dead in her bed several months later. Now, it struck home to me that trying to manage a disease in a procedure laboratory in a hospital was a very inadequate way to manage this disease. People often died at home, as my mom did, or even en route in an ambulance or car getting to the hospital. You've likely heard that about half the time, the first symptom of heart disease is death or a heart attack. So I asked, what if we could have predicted my mom's death a year ahead of time, 2 years, 5 years? Is there such a device? There's such a measure? There was, and this remains true even today. Back then, my friend Dr. John Rumberger, while at the Mayo Clinic, proved that calcium comprises about 20% of the total volume of atherosclerotic plaque in the coronary arteries. And you can see calcium very easily with a CAT scan, a CT scan. So he devised a way to measure calcium and show that this was a way to detect the presence of coronary atherosclerosis. That's the stuff that ruptures and causes a heart attack or progressively accumulates and blocks off blood flow to the heart. And then Dr. Arthur Agatston, you might recognize that name. He was the developer of the South Beach Diet, but he was also the developer of something called the Agatston Scoring System, a way to quantify calcium in the coronary arteries using a CT scanner. And that method continued to be used today. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about an Agatston score. And the science was accumulating back then, 20-some years ago, to show that the calcium score, the higher the calcium score, the more likely you were to have a heart attack or sudden cardiac death or develop symptoms of heart disease like chest pain. And it was a very, very powerful predictor, far superior to such weak markers like cholesterol. Well, it took some work and negotiations, but I finally got one of these scanning devices to come to Milwaukee. It was the first scanner in all of Wisconsin, one of the first in the entire Midwest. And we started scanning people. This is a place we called Milwaukee Heart Scan. It's a very easy test, involves just a little bit of radiation, like about 10 chest x-rays worth of radiation, not the 300 or more required for a full CT scan. And it was very rapid, and it yielded a coronary calcium score. Normal is zero. The higher the score, the more likely a heart attack, angina, chest pain, and other events become, such that by a score of about 1,000 is approximately about a 12 to 15% per year chance of having heart attack and similar events. And so people were going through the scan, of course, were uncovering hidden heart disease everywhere. Well, this is 27 years ago. What do you do about that? Well, this was before I developed a lot of my concepts. And so I told people, take a baby aspirin, take a high dose of a statin cholesterol drug like Lipitor, cut the fat in your diet, cut your saturated fat, follow an exercise program. The studies started to come out showing that if you did nothing, which of course is not very wise, the coronary calcium score goes up at a rate of 25% per year. It's horrifying how fast this stuff can grow in your coronary arteries. And then we help publish these data. If you go on a baby aspirin, high dose of a statin cholesterol drug, low-fat diet, exercise program, how fast does that score increase? How fast does plaque grow? 25% per year. Does nothing. To this day, my colleagues, other cardiologists, continue to call that useless collection of strategies optimal medical therapy. It's absurd, of course. Well, this left me with many, many people who were panicking because their scores were going up, and every time their score goes up 25% per year, they're closer and closer to dying, having a heart attack, or developing heart disease symptoms. If you asked some of the so-called experts in this area, what should we do with these relentlessly increasing coronary calcium scores that are not stopped at all by conventional therapies, they would say things like this. They actually did it in print. They said, well, stop scanning people, let them have their heart attacks or other symptoms, and then deal with it, which I think you now recognize as a miserably inadequate answer. So I was unhappy with that answer, so I started to seek out ways to put a stop to it. A lot of trial and error, but some successes. For instance, I learned that when I added vitamin D, in this case an oil-based gel cap, to achieve a 25-hydroxy vitamin D blood level of 60 to 70 nanograms per milliliter, it was the first time I saw scores drop. Before vitamin D, I'd managed to slow down the progression, maybe down to 12% or 15% or 8% even. But when I added vitamin D, it was the first time I saw calcium scores drop, plummet. 700, say, could drop to 380. The first few times I saw that, I didn't believe it. So I went back to the scans and compared one scan to another scan a year later. And yes, the calcium had shrunk. And even though this device is set up to show you the calcium, you can also see the contours of softer elements of plaque. You can actually see the edges. And it became clear that the plaque, the atherosclerotic plaque, had shrunk, had reversed. And I saw this over and over and over again. Well, it led to some other strategies. So one of the strategies that I engaged in was rejecting conventional cholesterol testing, because cholesterol testing is too crude. It's a very poor predictor of heart disease. The only reason why cholesterol testing is as popular as it is because it makes a lot of money for the pharmaceutical industry. I rejected that idea and started doing a much more advanced method called lipoprotein testing. In other words, cholesterol testing was meant to be an indirect way of guesstimating what the lipoproteins, fat-carrying proteins in the blood, were doing. Their size, their character, their number. Well, we could actually measure lipoproteins. That method has been around for 30 years. So I started submitting blood for lipoprotein testing. And consistent with the scientific literature, not my science, other people's, from places like University of California, Berkeley, Johns Hopkins, and other notable places, it was clear that the small LDL particles, not LDL cholesterol, small LDL particles were the consistent cause of coronary atherosclerosis. This has since been borne out in 55 studies. That is the best, one of the best predictors for why people develop coronary atherosclerosis is an excess of small LDL particles. If you use a method called nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR, and all that means, we take the clear part of your blood without red blood cells, put in a large magnetic field, and it separates the proteins. You can analyze them for the number and character of the proteins, the lipoproteins in the bloodstream. Well, when you do this via the NMR technique, you see that almost always people with coronary disease, like a positive coronary calcium score, have lots and lots of small LDL particles, typically something like 1,800 nanomoles per liter, particle count per volume. And the science was clear. There's only two groups of foods that cause formation of small LDL particles, grains and sugars, the amylopectin A of grains and sugars, of all forms of sugar, sucrose, fructose, glucose. You also come to rapidly appreciate by seeing these lipoproteins that fat, total fat, and saturated fat have nothing to do with abnormalities in the bloodstream. So I asked people, based on these and this science, to remove all wheat, grains, and sugars from their diet, sources of amylopectin A and sugars. Well, they did so. I rechecked their small LDL particles, and it would drop from maybe 1,800 to zero, or some other very low number. In other words, it wasn't a 30% improvement, 40% improvement. It was, for the most part, decimation, elimination, obliteration of small LDL particles. It's also important to understand why small LDL particles are different. One, they're smaller, of course, right? So they're better able to work their way into the walls of arteries. They're also, because of their small size, they also have an altered surface shape or conformation. And it means the recognition proteins, called apoprotein B, on small LDL particles is not recognized by the human liver. And so small LDL particles, after being provoked by consumption, say, of a slice of pizza or a bagel or a sandwich, those small LDL particles persist for 5 to 7 days. Unlike large LDL particles provoked by fat or oil consumption that are cleared by the liver within 24 hours of creation. And so once you have anything made of grains or sugars, you form tons of these small LDL particles that are unusually persistent. They're also more prone to oxidation, which makes them much more likely to cause atherosclerotic plaque. They're also much more inflammatory when they enter the arterial wall. So small LDL particles triggered by the consumption of grain, wheat, grains, and sugars is a flagrant trigger for the development of coronary disease, coronary atherosclerosis. So this idea of cutting fat, eating more healthy whole grains is a flagrant trigger for heart disease. There's no need to cut total fat. There's no need to cut saturated fat. There never was any solid science proving that those things, fat and oils, cause heart disease. But there is plenty of science to tell us that the formation of small LDL particles is a very powerful predictor for future heart attack and related events and for coronary atherosclerosis. So that's why, in my programs, we eat no wheat, no grains, nor sugars, and we see small LDL particles and associated measures drop to the floor. It also means that what is often called heart-healthy diets actually cause or contribute to heart disease. That's how bad the conventional message can be. Another thing that most cardiologists won't tell you or don't understand, I touched on just a few minutes ago, and that is the uselessness, the poor predictive value of cholesterol values, whether it's total cholesterol or LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol. These are so deeply flawed, they should have been abandoned decades ago. So the whole notion of measuring cholesterol came about in the 1950s and 1960s, when two researchers at the National Institutes of Health, Dr. William Fredrickson and William Friedewald, were trying to quantify or understand the lipoproteins, once again, in the bloodstream. Well, this was 1958, 1960. Technology had not advanced too far by then, and it was very difficult to try to count microscopic particles in the blood. But they did notice that when they take the clear part of blood, that is the plasma, the part minus red blood cells, and spun it down in a centrifuge at high speed, layers formed. And they recognized that different layers had different kinds of particles in them. They wanted to count them. Well, how do you count particles that are microscopic in 1958, 1960? Well, they reasoned, what if we knew what was in each particle? And could we just measure one thing in them? So they could have measured triglycerides. They all have triglycerides, all these particles. They could have measured that apoprotein B protein. They chose to measure cholesterol as an indirect gauge or dipstick for how many particles were in each layer. And then they developed a crude equation so that they didn't have to measure each and every layer. There are several layers. They measured the total cholesterol content of the entire plasma sample. They measured the cholesterol content in the highest density that was at the bottom. They measured the cholesterol content in the very low density that was at the top. And they didn't want to measure the cholesterol in the low density, kind of mid fraction. So they developed a very crude equation to guesstimate how much cholesterol was in the low density lipoprotein fraction. They had to make a number of assumptions for this equation to calculate LDL cholesterol to work. These assumptions included that we all eat the same diet, which of course is ridiculous, that we all have low triglyceride levels, which is completely not true, that nobody is diabetic, and some other assumptions. And so this calculation. So if you look in your conventional cholesterol panel, you'll see LDL cholesterol, and in parentheses, calculated. It's not even measured. That calculation is wildly inaccurate because of those assumptions and because all it's doing, you're measuring cholesterol in the entire sample and trying to guesstimate how much is in the low-density lipoprotein fraction. Of course, when you look at the actual lipoprotein testing and compare it to LDL cholesterol, you'll see there's almost no relationship. LDL cholesterol is a fiction. It is not true. It is nonsense. Yet it's the number one thing measured by most of my colleagues. It's a thing they try to treat with their statin cholesterol and other drugs. Now, if cholesterol testing was the only test available, I could understand, right? We could understand resorting to using that measure. But the better tests are already available. Tests like lipoproteins, NMR lipoproteins that have been shown to be far superior in predicting who's going to have a heart attack, who's going to develop coronary calcium scores, and what to do about it. Now, here's the kicker. When you watch people with small LDL particles, you start to realize that it is wonderfully responsive to diet, like we mentioned, and it does not require drugs to control. And that's one of the reasons why you hear almost nothing about this, because there's no pot of gold for the pharmaceutical industry. And so we're not talking, hardly anybody talks about this flagrant cause of coronary disease. Instead, talk about this fictitious number called LDL cholesterol that has almost no basis in reality, yet is the basis for lots of prescription pharmaceuticals. The Defiant Health Podcast is sponsored by Paleo Valley, makers of delicious grass-fed beef sticks, healthy snack bars, and other products. We are very picky around here and insist that any product we consider has no junk ingredients like maltodextrin, carrageenan, carboxymethylcellulose, sucralose, and of course, no added sugars. And all Paleo Valley products contain no gluten nor grains. In fact, I find Paleo Valley products among the cleanest of any in their category, and they're truly delicious. One of the habits I urge everyone to get into is to include a fermented food product at least once, if not several times per day, in their lifestyles. Unlike nearly all other beef sticks available, the Paleo Valley grass-fed beef sticks are all naturally fermented, meaning they contain probiotic bacterial species. And now, Paleo Valley is expanding their Wild Pastures program that provides 100% grass-fed, grass-finished, pastured beef and pastured chicken and pork, raised without herbicides or pesticides and raised in the USA. And they've just added wild-caught seafood caught from the waters of Bristol Bay, Alaska. They're now offering a 20% lifetime discount on every order for a limited time. I'll post the web address in the Defiant Health show notes. Shipping for Paleo Valley products is free for orders of $75 or more. For more information or to order, go to paleovalley.com. That's PaleoValley.com. Enter the coupon code DEFIANT, not case sensitive, for a 15% discount to Defiant Health listeners. The web address is also listed in the Defiant Health show notes that accompany this podcast. And be sure to take a look at their other products, such as their organic super greens, rich with phytonutrients, and their superfood bars that come in dark chocolate chip, apple cinnamon, and lemon meringue. They're low carb, of course, with 8 grams net carbs per bar. The Paleo Valley folks have been busy, recently adding some interesting new products, including chocolate-flavored grass-fed bone broth protein, grass-fed organ complex in capsule form, and, for the fall season, pumpkin spice super food bars with grass-fed bone broth protein. And for listeners to the Defiant Health podcast, you can apply your discount code for a 15% discount. The discount code can be found in the show notes. You may know that, in addition to writing books, blogs, and helping to educate people on how to achieve genuine health, I also co-founded a research and development company called Realize Therapeutics Corporation, and I serve as the chief medical officer. I'd therefore like to tell you about a product that I personally formulated that we call Oxysuitics Gut2Glow, a combination of ingredients consumed orally for skin health and appearance. It is truly a revolutionary product. There is, to my knowledge, no other product like Gut2Glow. As most of you know, I have been impressed with the skin and other health benefits that develop with replacement of the microbe lost from the gastrointestinal microbiota of most modern people, Lactobacillus reuteri. Many of you have successfully cultivated this microbe to high counts, as yogurt, but many have also asked for a more convenient way to obtain this important microbe to give you a break for making yogurt or for situations such as travel or giving gifts. I listened, but I went several steps further. In addition to providing high counts of Lactobacillus reuteri, we added several components to amplify skin benefits. Marine-sourced collagen hydrolysates, enriched in the di- and tripeptides that exert many of the skin benefits of collagen, including stimulating the deposition of more collagen in the dermal layer of skin. Hyaluronic acid, that increases moisture in the dermal layer of skin and also acts as a prebiotic fiber in the GI tract for additional health benefits. Astaxanthin, a carotenoid relative of beta-carotene, but with greater anti-inflammatory and antioxidative benefits. Gut2Glow is formulated to provide beauty from within, actually adding to skin moisture, smoothness, and an increase in dermal collagen that results, over time, in reduced wrinkle depth. Our preliminary experience suggests that improvements in skin moisture, smoothness, and reduction of wrinkles begins after 4 weeks, with further improvements over 8 to 12 weeks and beyond. I invite you to take a look at some of the results on the Oxysuitics Gut2Glow website, web address in the show notes. Another important fact that most of my colleagues will not tell you about, that while I bash this idea of testing for cholesterol, so the 4 values on a standard cholesterol panel are total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, triglycerides, and then that calculated value calculated from the other values called LDL cholesterol, this widely inaccurate value. Now, while all the attention is paid to LDL cholesterol, few pay attention to triglycerides. That's the most important value on the entire thing. So while cholesterol testing is outdated and not very helpful, there can be some useful information buried in there. And it's triglycerides that tell a lot of the story. Triglycerides are fats. So if you have olive oil, that's a bottle of triglycerides. If you have butter, that's a stick of triglycerides. If you have any other oil, they're all forms of triglycerides. So fats are triglycerides, oils are triglycerides, triglycerides are fats and oils. Now, when they measure triglycerides in the bloodstream, they're really not measuring triglycerides that are free, because you can't have free-floating fat in the bloodstream, or else it would cause embolism. It would block blood flow in various organs. So what it really represents is the triglycerides floating around mostly in what's called the very low-density lipoprotein fraction, VLDL. Because it's rich in oils or fats, it's very low-density, just like salad dressing. If you have vinegar and oil, what floats to the top? The oil floats to the top because it's very low density. Same thing with triglycerides, fats, in VLDL particles, they're very low density. And you'll find that triglycerides and VLDL particles are essentially synonymous. In other words, that simple triglyceride measure on your blood test, on your cholesterol test, accurately reflects how much VLDL particles you have. So if your triglyceride level on your cholesterol panel is 55, let's say, milligrams per deciliter, you have very few VLDL particles. If your triglyceride level is 248, you have lots of VLDL particles. So you'll find that a cutoff of 60 milligrams per deciliter is the difference between having no VLDL or very minimal VLDL below 60, and above 60, the higher the number, the more VLDL particles you have. Why is that important? Well, several things. VLDL particles themselves cause atherosclerotic plaque and thereby lead over time to heart attack and related events. So having a high triglyceride level of, say, 110, 150 is very important as a risk factor for heart disease. Now, if you'll get the lab report, they'll often say 150 or greater is of concern. That's nonsense. Let's ask this question. At what level of triglycerides do you begin to form a lot of VLDL particles? 60 milligrams per deciliter. So VLDL particles begin to show up in large numbers when you see a triglyceride level of 60 milligrams per deciliter or greater. Another reason why that's important, the triglycerides, is if you have a higher triglyceride level above 60 milligrams per deciliter, it means those VLDL particles are available in the bloodstream and they interact with LDL particles, and that's the process that begins a series of reactions that make the small LDL particle. So when you have the higher your triglycerides on your cholesterol panel, the more likely it is you have small LDL particles. It's not directly measuring small LDL particles, but you know that the high level of triglycerides and thereby VLDL causes formation of small LDL particles. And at that level of 150, they often quote, you have tons of small LDL particles. Another reason why the triglycerides are very important is because it reflects a process in your liver called lipogenesis, or de novo lipogenesis. And all that means is whenever you eat carbohydrates or sugars, carbohydrates such as the amylopectin A of wheat and grains, or sugars like sucrose, table sugar, fructose, or glucose, your liver is very good at converting those sugars to triglycerides. That's called lipogenesis. That is the manufacture of fats. Well, some of those triglycerides stay put in the liver. And that's how fatty liver comes about. It's one of the big causes of fatty liver. Some of the other triglycerides go out to the bloodstream packaged as VLDL particles. So whenever your triglyceride blood level on a conventional cholesterol panel is above 60 milligrams per deciliter, it suggests your liver's been busy engaging in that process of lipogenesis, and that's adding to fatty liver, it's adding to VLDL particles that cause heart disease. So of the four values on a standard cholesterol panel, the most important, not cholesterol, not total cholesterol, not LDL cholesterol, triglycerides, because it tells you so much about diet, what's going on in your liver, and whether you have VLDL particles causing heart disease. Another thing my colleagues won't tell you. So they talk about, right, saturated fat and cholesterol, but don't talk about insulin resistance and inflammation. These are two fundamental processes that add to the risk from small LDL particles and VLDL particles and make both those things worse. So anything that causes insulin resistance and inflammation adds to cardiovascular risk. Insulin resistance is the ubiquitous process that two-thirds of Americans now have because of a number of reasons that include being given ridiculous dietary guidelines that say cut your fat, eat more healthy whole grains, sedentary lifestyles, consumption of processed foods rich in carbs, and consumption of unhealthy oils like linoleic acid-rich corn oil or mixed vegetable oil. All these things contribute to insulin resistance. And all that means is your muscle, brain, liver, other organs have lost their ability to respond to insulin. So your pancreas compensates by producing more and more insulin to overcome that resistance, because insulin is supposed to make glucose available to the cells. So your pancreas overproduces insulin. If you take somebody who's insulin sensitive, let's say a slender 23-year-old premenopausal long-distance running female, her fasting insulin level will be something like 1 or 2 microunits per liter, because her body, her organs are very responsive to insulin. And the pancreas doesn't have to make very much. What if we took a 240-pound woman who's got a lot of visceral fat in her abdomen and check her fasting insulin? Her levels are likely to be something like 90 or 68 or 130, not a little bit worse, far worse. And that is a reflection of her organs that are unresponsive to insulin, so the pancreas overproduces huge quantities of insulin. Well, that much insulin floating around, this is very common, causes weight gain. It causes growth of visceral fat, that's fat encircling the abdominal organs, that's very inflammatory. It blocks weight loss, and it turns up that process of liver lipogenesis that converts carbohydrates to triglycerides and thereby VLDL and adding further heart disease risk. So insulin resistance is a critical process that makes the whole picture of cardiovascular risk worse. And inflammation. The more visceral fat you have because you're insulin resistant, the more inflammation you have, and you can see this reflected in inflammatory measures like C-reactive protein, interleukin-6, interleukin-1 beta, TNF-alpha, and many others. So it's the combination of insulin resistance and inflammation caused by a diet low in fat, rich in healthy whole grains. So it's not cholesterol that's causing heart disease. It's the combination of small LDL particles, VLDL, all amplified by insulin resistance and inflammation. Now, it's important to know one of the things I do in my programs is we address common nutrient deficiencies that affect modern people. This is not because of the diet, but because of modern lifestyles. For instance, we have to drink filtered water. We can't drink water from a river or stream, right? It's got sewage and farm runoff and other things. You'd get sick. So the city filters it, or you filter, or both, and water filtration removes all magnesium. And magnesium impacts inflammation and insulin resistance, so we address that. Most people are deficient in vitamin D because we live in northern climates, or we work indoors a lot, or we wear clothes that covers a lot of surface area and prevents sun activation of vitamin D in the skin, and we lose vitamin D, the ability to activate vitamin D in the skin as we get older. So most people are vitamin D deficient. Replace it, and insulin resistance improves, inflammation improves. Likewise, iodine and omega-3 fatty acids, put all those four together, and they are synergistic. And you have a marked reduction in insulin resistance and inflammation. Did your cardiologist mention that to you? So once again, this ridiculous focus on cholesterol and saturated fat drew attention away from the real factors that cause heart disease. Now, lastly, the last thing I'm going to talk about that most cardiologists will not tell you about is this very powerful risk factor for heart disease called endotoxemia. And all that means is that as modern people, we have decimated our gastrointestinal microbiomes. That is, we normally should have trillions of microbes located mostly in the colon, the large bowel. Well, our exposure to repeated courses of antibiotics, it's not uncommon for a 40-year-old to have taken 30 courses of antibiotics. Children, 1,300 prescriptions. More than 1,300 prescriptions are written every year for every 1,000 children, every year. So wild exposure, overexposure to antibiotics, our exposure to the herbicide glyphosate and Roundup. It's an herbicide, but it's also an antibiotic. Food preservatives prevent growth of microbes in your food, that is rot. They also prevent microbe growth in your gastrointestinal tract. Other things that disrupt the gastrointestinal microbiome, emulsifying agents like polysorbate 80 or carboxymethylcellulose in common foods like ice cream or salad dressing to keep them mixed, also emulsify or disrupt the mucus barrier. And that changes the intestinal microbiome. There's many other factors. Point is, we have massively disrupted the gastrointestinal microbiome. Among the effects is we've lost hundreds of helpful species. These species did good things for us. One of the things they did was help suppress the growth and proliferation of unhealthy microbes. You might recognize some of these. E. coli, Salmonella, Campylobacter. These are also causes of food poisoning. So when you lose healthy microbes from whatever reason, too many antibiotics, emulsifying agents, etc., it allows these fecal microbes to proliferate and then ascend up from the colon. So they're supposed to stay in the colon where they belong. The colon has a thick two-layer mucus barrier to protect the intestinal lining. Well, when these fecal species ascend into the 24 feet of small intestine, the small intestine is not well equipped to deal with them. It has a much thinner single-layer mucus barrier. Now, these microbes only live for a few hours at a time. So people develop 30 feet of trillions of microbes turning over rapidly every few hours. When they die, they release a component of their cell walls called endotoxin. And because they're in the small intestine, poorly adapted to these fecal microbes, the endotoxin breakdown products get into the bloodstream, and that's called endotoxemia. And endotoxemia is a very powerful cause for insulin resistance and inflammation, the phenomena that amplify production of small LDL particles and VLDL particles because they turn up liver lipogenesis. So endotoxemia plays a major role in contributing to the factors that lead to coronary disease, as well as many other diseases that include depression, migraine, headaches, rosacea, psoriasis, joint pains, fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, other autoimmune diseases, other neurodegenerative disorders, on and on. But it also plays a role. Endotoxemia also plays a role in cardiovascular risk and coronary atherosclerosis and coronary disease. Now, you can recognize this process, that is overgrowth of fecal microbes in the small bowel that we call small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO. You can recognize it because you have some telltale signs such as fat malabsorption, that is fat droplets in the toilet, food intolerances of all sorts, that is intolerance to legumes, to FODMAPs, fibers and sugars, or to histamine-containing foods or nightshades, or you went through some blood tests like IgG testing for food intolerances. These are all forms of SIBO. And there's nothing wrong with the food. There's something wrong with you. That is, you have SIBO allowing breakdown products of food and other abnormal reactions to make you intolerant. The solution is not to stop the food. You can stop the food to reduce your suffering, your symptoms, but the real solution is to address the SIBO. Other signs are having conditions virtually synonymous with SIBO, especially irritable bowel syndrome, fibromyalgia, restless leg syndrome, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, celiac disease, any autoimmune disease, any neurodegenerative disorder, and many others. So if you have any of these conditions, you can pretty much count on having SIBO and thereby endotoxemia. Now, unfortunately, there are only limited ways to detect this process of endotoxemia. We could measure endotoxin, but it's only available for research purposes, not yet clinically available. So we can't do that. There are some indirect measures if you ever have a test called serum zonulin. That can reflect endotoxemia. That's a measure of intestinal permeability. If you ever have a stool test, an increase in the level of calprotectin can suggest intestinal inflammation and thereby endotoxemia. But the test that's probably the most helpful in determining whether or not you have SIBO is to measure hydrogen gas on the breath. Bacteria produce hydrogen gas, but we cannot. So you can use measurement of hydrogen gas as a method to map where in the gastrointestinal tract microbes are living. There's also now a consumer device called the AIR device, A-I-R-E, made by a company called Food Marble. I'll put these names in the show notes. I have no relationship with them except that I've come to know the inventor, Dr. Angus Short, PhD engineer in Dublin, Ireland, because I called him because he thought this was a device only to help people with irritable bowel syndrome to navigate a low FODMAPs diet. When I got the device back in 2018, I called him up. I said, Angus, that's not the only application of this device. You can also use it as a mapping device. Now, how to do that? You have to see my Super Gut book because the instructions with the device don't tell you how to do this. He's going to change those instructions, but hasn't done so yet. So you find instructions on how to use the AIR device as a mapping device in my Super Gut book. It's also in my website, drdavisinfinitehealth.com, in the membership part. Now, if you have SIBO, how do you get rid of it? Well, it depends on who you ask. Most of my colleagues, most doctors, cardiologists, even gastroenterologists, primary care doctors, won't even know what it is. The science is too new. So they'll say things like, did you consult Dr. Google again? Or there's nothing wrong with you? Don't waste my time. All those kinds of pat answers you know about. If you do find a doctor, maybe a gastroenterologist who does know something about SIBO and endotoxemia, they'll give you a prescription for Xifaxan, an antibiotic. Now, wait a minute. Didn't antibiotics get us here in the first place for a lot of us? So I'm reluctant to suggest that an antibiotic is the solution. So I asked some different questions. I asked, what if you took a commercial probiotic off the shelf? Would it make your SIBO and thereby endotoxemia go away? No. You'd still have 30 feet of microbes turning over rapidly. You might have a little bit of reduction in bloating or diarrhea, but the SIBO typically does not go away. So I asked further questions. I asked, what if we chose probiotic species and strains that colonize the upper GI tract, the small bowel, where SIBO occurs? And what if we chose species and strains that are known to produce what are called bacteriocins? These are natural antibiotics effective against those fecal microbes from the colon. So I chose three species and strains: a strain of Lactobacillus gasseri, an upper GI colonizer and vigorous producer of bacteriocins; Lactobacillus reuteri, likewise upper GI colonization, produces bacteriocins; and a strain of Bacillus coagulans that also adds another bacteriocin. We go further by making a fermented food, typically yogurt, using extended fermentation to get really high bacterial counts. So we ferment it for 36 hours, and we perform flow cytometry. We get something like 250 to 300 billion microbes per half cup serving. Now, this is anecdote, but 40 people in my groups have tried it, and 90% have responded with normalization of hydrogen gas on the breath using the air device. Now, even better, people who normalize their hydrogen gas on their breath with the air device also say things like this: my irritable bowel syndrome symptoms finally went away completely. My ulcerative colitis finally went away completely. My hemoglobin A1C, that was really high in a type 2 diabetic range of 11.7%, dropped to 6.1% on the diet and nutrients, but I was stuck. They corrected their SIBO and endotoxemia. It drops to something like 4.7% or 4.8%. In other words, the reduction in SIBO, the reduction in breath hydrogen gas, the receding of fecal microbes in the small bowel was accompanied by marked improvements of any residual problem. So I call this SIBO yogurt. Some people call it super gut yogurt after my book. But it has performed far beyond expectations. I would have been happy with a 30% response, but now we're seeing something like 90%. So we will perform a formal clinical trial to validate all this. But in the meantime, you know, if I told you that if you have SIBO and endotoxemia, the solution is to remove your colon, we better be damn certain that's really necessary, right? But what if I told you the solution could be something as benign as something that looks like yogurt? Well, that's pretty darn benign. So you don't have to be absolutely confident. You don't need the air device. It's nice to have, but you don't need it. You can go by those telltale signs, for instance, food intolerances, etc., and just assume you have it and then consume the SIBO yogurt. Most people require a minimum of 4 weeks. And by the way, I kind of regret calling it SIBO yogurt because it suggests it's only useful during SIBO eradication. I think it's actually useful long term. So once you've normalized hydrogen breath, or you've gotten rid of some symptom or telltale sign of SIBO, I would stay on occasion, maybe every second or third or fourth day, just to continue to populate your upper GI tract with those microbes. Because what we're seeing now also is continued consumption of those microbes, what I would regard as keystone, a very important foundational species, seems to be preventing SIBO recurrences, which are very common. Now, there you have it. Five things that the vast majority of cardiologists will not tell you, even though they are flagrant and potent causes for heart disease. Now, if you've learned something from this podcast, I invite you to subscribe to the Defiant Health Podcast through your favorite podcast directory, to leave a review, leave a comment, and tell your friends. I hope you are starting to really understand what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to educate people and giving you tools and information that empower you, because you cannot count on the healthcare system or doctors to give you all this information. Thanks for listening.